Well, members, we're going to get the meeting started here. We don't quite have a quorum yet. And for everyone's information, we'll hold the minutes for yesterday's meeting till tomorrow. There's a slight change that has to be made, so correction. So we'll take care of the minutes tomorrow. So with that, Representative Erdahl, welcome to the meeting. And introduce yourself, and I can't move the bill yet because we're not here, but we don't have enough here. But you can proceed, and we'll get moved from here.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good to be here today. And I'm doing the Fort Snelling request. I do have an amendment that I would like to offer first, and I would like to incorporate an oral amendment into it.
So, Representative Dean, go ahead with your oral or your modification.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On line 1-2, I just want to substitute 12 million for 13 million.
Okay,
so strike 13, put in 12, and
so your amendment will be 12 million. Will be 12 million. Yeah. So we'll just, when we get a quorum, we'll take care of that.
Right.
Then, so
delete the 15 and put in 12. They were just saving money for the state already this morning.
Representative Erdahl, you know that doesn't go into your pocket, right? Anyway, proceed.
All right, thank you. You're, I think, all aware of the importance to our state's history and to the state of Minnesota of historic Fort Snelling. And a renovation has been begun there. In last year's capital investment bill, we appropriated $15 million to basically reconstruct a visitor center and do some more work at the fort. Another $12 million is needed to finish that project. And so I rather than me trying to explain exactly what has and what will be done, I have a couple of experts here with me that can do a better job than I, and so I will turn it over to them.
Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the tape and then proceed.
My name is Kent Whitworth. I'm the director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society. With me is David Kelleher, our director of public policy, and also with us are our three deputy directors, Melanie Adams, who is oversees our learning initiatives, Jennifer Jones, who oversees preservation and outreach, and Doug Marty is our deputy director for administration. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, and Representative Erdahl for bringing this bill forward. Today we'd like to provide a brief overview of the site, what's there, what we hope to accomplish in the project, and where we plan to go from here. You see from the slide there, and I hope many of you have visited historic Fort Snelling. If you haven't, we would be delighted to arrange to tour you at that historic site. I think we'd all prefer to do that in a warmer time of year, but I do believe we've had some Boy Scouts out there in the last couple of weekends, so we are continuing to use the historic site through the winter months. You notice from that overview that historic Fort Snelling is located in a major metropolitan area. It's at a crossroads of modern transportation routes, as well as at the confluence of two rivers. This site has played a prominent role in history literally for centuries. This is one of the most historic sites in Minnesota. In fact, it was the first historic landmark, which signals national significance. It's, I think, arguably of international significance as well. We have been working on this project for a number of years, as many of you know. We have completed a master plan, and a pre-design package is finished. This diagram gives you a sense of where things are located at the site. To your right, you'll see the historic fort, often referred to as the Diamond, and then there are three additional historic buildings. The fort obviously will continue to be an integral part of the visitor experience at historic Fort Snelling. But this particular project will enable us to preserve several of these other buildings to create interpretive programs, educational spaces, and enhance the overall visitor experience. The current visitor center, which was built in the late 70s, early 80s, and if you've been out there, you know it was underground, constructed in the days when we felt like that was a good idea. In retrospect, I'm not sure that was as wise as we thought. And frankly, the building has leaked since day one. There are a couple of images here that indicate some of the challenges we've had, both with water leaks and foundation issues as well. We have conducted engineering studies on the current visitor center and come to the conclusion that it's not a wise investment for us to continue to pour capital dollars into this existing visitor center. Moving on to the next image, there's an aerial view of Building 18, and you see there originally those were cavalry barracks, and also Building 22. These buildings are really the focus of this capital project. In addition to the work on these buildings, we'll also be making improvements to the landscape and providing interpretive trails and better wayfinding for visitors. If we could zero in a little bit more on Building 18, this is where the bulk of the work will take place. As I mentioned, this will include education space, orientation space, as well as some rental space and a museum shop. If you look in on this particular image, you begin to get a better feel for those particular functions for Building 18 and for Building 22. These bubble diagrams have very simplified versions of how we use the space, but the visitor center, as I mentioned, includes multipurpose space. It includes about a 4,000 square foot exhibition gallery, and then programming space for general audiences as well as school groups. Of course, restrooms and museum shop are a part of that as well. I'm going to hand off to my colleague David Kelleher to summarize the budget information.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. On this slide, you can see a summary of the budget aspects of this project. And as Kent mentioned, we've been at this for a while, starting with an appropriation for pre-design in 2015, followed by an appropriation for design in 2017, and then in last year's capital budget bill in 2018, an appropriation to start construction. And as Representative Erdahl noted, that was a portion, half of what we had requested for this project. So what we did in the interim was to go back to our architects with the idea that there's no assurance that there would be any additional funding in a subsequent bonding bill, whether there would be a bonding bill. So we said we have to plan this out in such a way that we could we do something with the funding that is available, and could we add on later on should more funds become available. So this is the revised plan that we have come up with in a couple of different stages. It's also important to note on the next line that we have been very successful in raising private, non-state money for this project. Minnesotans love historic Fort Snelling and have contributed a great deal of money. We have $12 million in hand. We have additional money that is pledged that is not in hand at this moment, and we'll figure out how to deal with that as those pledges become available in the coming years, whether they're planned gifts or other ways that people will contribute to this really important project. So the request that's before you this year to do additional work is $12 million, and that would go towards construction, adding Building 22, the one-story ordnance munitions building that's adjacent to Building 18 that Kent talked about, and some additional interpretive landscaping on-site to help people understand not only what happened inside the walls of the fort, but what did happen over history in the area around there. This, of course, is at the confluence of the Minnesota and Mississippi rivers. It's a really, really important place going back centuries and millennia. And I think visitors today often will visit the site and spend a day or a half a day and not really know that they're next to the Mississippi River. So we want to make sure that they are connected to the Mississippi River.
Great. Thank you, David. And I might just add regarding Building 22, the primary focus of that space, if we do receive additional funding, will be not only an orientation to the historic Fort Snelling, but also the entire Fort Snelling footprint to provide additional context for the many ways that the public interact with the overall Fort Snelling property. So as David said, not only are these historic structures of great significance, the diamond and these later historic buildings that would be rehabilitated for these new purposes, but it's the stories throughout that site and that entire area that are so compelling. And we'll go to the next image there. And this is just a quick summary of the various themes that we pursue in terms of programming and guided experiences throughout the year. If you look, obviously it starts with a military history and a veteran story, but the story of freedom, as so many of us know, is presented through the very particular story of Dred and Harriet Scott. We have just this past season introduced an interpretation of the Japanese American Language School that had a profound impact on World War II. And obviously, the Native American story at that confluence is very compelling, and landscaping in particular will be a key to bringing those interpretive themes to life. And this is what makes that site not just significant at the state level or even the national level, but at the international level. History, as we had a chance to talk briefly at the budget overview hearing, is complex and compelling, and this project is going to enable us to develop a variety of interpretive themes and add real value to the visitor experience for the next several generations who will enjoy and be challenged and inspired by Fort Snelling. So we have got a short video that lasts just over a minute that maybe adds some even more compelling images to our presentation.
Two mighty rivers, many cultures, thousands of years of rich history. In 2020, historic Fort Snelling will be 200 years old, and it shows. The fort's buildings, grounds, and programs are in urgent need of revitalization. Our plan includes a new visitor center in renovated cavalry barracks, outdoor spaces that promote learning, reflection, and connection to the natural beauty of this extraordinary place. New exhibits and programs that showcase the many unique stories that unfolded here on sacred Dakota homeland. It's where soldiers trained to defend our country and where an enslaved family began its quest for freedom. Historic Fort Snelling, Minnesota's first national historic landmark.
That concludes our presentation. We'd be happy to field questions.
Any questions? Representative Green.
Thank you. Just a couple of questions. You've been given money in the past, and you've got money on hand. What have you done so far? I mean, is it all in disrepair? Is it being used? What's been done up to this point?
The site is open to the public and will remain open to the public throughout the construction project. We have finished the master plan, the pre-design phase. We're finishing up design construction documents so that the capital project, the physical work, can actually begin late this calendar year after the tour season.
Representative Green.
So Oh, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kelleher. I would say also, over the years, if you look at the slide that's up there, the buildings with the red roofs, the cavalry barracks, we have done extensive work through asset preservation on those to make sure that they're secure, water doesn't get in, the roofs are tiled roofs that are 100 years old. We got 100 years out of those roofs, which is a good thing. But we repaired and replaced those roofs about 5 or 6 years ago, did some tuck pointing on the sides of the building. So we've been caring for the buildings on site, including the diamond, the historic fort, over time. But this particular project is to take it to the next level and do some work for interpretive features inside the Cavalry Barracks building.
Representative Green.
Okay, thank you. So with what you've proposed here, if you should get this, I'll just ask the two questions now, and then everybody can move on. If you should get this, is this going to finish it? I mean, will you, or are you going to be back every year for more? And and the other thing is, on the existing visitor center, you said it's been leaking since day one. Well, maybe those leaks are part of history. Let's leave them. but seriously, is that one just going to be taken down and removed and build all new then, or what's going to happen with it?
Chairman Nelson, Representative Green, the previous legislation specifically called for the demolition and removal of the current visitor center, and so that'll be among some of the first work to take place later this fall in terms of removing that underground visitor center. And then to address the other question, we do not intend to come back every year asking for a little bit more and a little bit more. This will get us where we need to be for a number of years going forward, both from a preservation standpoint and from a visitor experience standpoint. So,
Representative Green.
Well, that's good to know. Then it raises two more questions. One, if you don't get this money, do you have enough to proceed with some of the stuff as well? And then in your budget plan, do you have asset preservation figured into that so you can set it aside as you're moving forward so you don't have to come back?
Mr. Whitworth.
Chairman Nelson, Representative Green, we as David Kelleher mentioned, this past summer and fall, we took a look at the money that we had in hand, both from the public and private sectors, to see if we could accomplish the goals of the project. And that's where we did come to the conclusion that we did have enough to proceed. Frankly, if the additional funding doesn't come, what won't take place is the rehabilitation of Building 22, and a good bit of the landscape work will not proceed. But we would proceed with Building 18, the wayfinding, and then a more modest approach to the landscaping. And I'll yield to David with regard to asset preservation.
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, we always have asset preservation requests for our network of historic sites ranging from Split Rock Lighthouse to Jeffers Petroglyphs. We have historic buildings and modern buildings that we need to take care of, so that's always part of our capital budget requests. Asset preservation is part of that, and we are getting caught up at this point, but I'm not sure that we'll ever fully get caught up. To take care of those buildings. It's an ongoing process.
Representative Green. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure to which testifier, but how many finished square feet will we have when this is all completed of usable building space?
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, I'm not sure I have that exact figure right at my fingertips. I think I might need to get back to you on that. I think it's on the order of, I want to say, about 20,000 square feet in Building 18, but I just don't have that right in front of me at the moment. So I'll get back to you on that.
Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I've seen numbers on this before that it could be, the whole project might be even 40 or 50,000 square feet, but even if it is, I'm coming out that if you spend $46.5 million for, say, 40,000 square feet, you're approaching $1,200 a square foot. And I'm wondering how it can be that high. I mean, you know, even the university buildings, which I've questioned in the past at $500 to $600 a square foot, to me is a little bit high. But any comments?
Yeah, Mr. Kelleher. Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, the total project cost represents quite a bit more than just Building 18 and Building 22. There's a lot of in the total project, as you can see on this image. Landscaping, which is not just planting trees, it's interpretive landscapes, trails, overlooks of the Mississippi. So, you know, in the design process, we've worked with the architects on, you know, the per unit cost of the landscaping, and certainly Building 18 as a historic building that has been vacant for a number of years is going to be fairly costly to rehabilitate into a museum visitor center. But it's not that level of cost per square foot, because the total project cost includes design, those non-building, non-structural costs as well, in addition to other program development costs and things like that. So I think the building cost really of the project is more in the neighborhood for the full project is more in the neighborhood of $28-29 million.
And Representative Mr. Chairman,
Representative Erdahl,
if I might add that the you know, construction, the reconstruction, remodeling of historic buildings almost always contains a higher cost, just because of the nature of the historic building.
Representative Earl, Representative Mahoney and myself sometimes have that discussion where it'd be cheaper to tear some stuff down and build completely new, but in the event or in the case of historic buildings and we want to preserve, we end up getting caught with, or stuck with more cost just in the nature of the work that's being done on them. So, Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I realize that, but I think we also have to be prudent with the taxpayer money and ask some questions as far as the cost, and I'm wondering if maybe some of that information might be available and forwarded to me or us relative to the specific, not, you know, getting down to the nitty-gritty, but at least looking at the major cost within this. And if you're redoing the barracks, sure, it costs this much, and there's this many square feet, and the visitor center, and so forth. So at least we have some idea of what's going on here.
I see them shaking their heads at the table, and
thank you.
I'm writing himself a note so that we can, they'll be getting that information. Representative Claiborne.
Chairman and testifiers, having lived in homes that were over 100 years of age, I do appreciate the surprise of the week. So when I am looking at this budget request, which is in a downward motion, and I understanding human behavior that we often overestimate the positives and underestimate the negatives, I'm wondering if there is in this budget a place for that surprise of the week.
Mr. Whitworth.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we've done a very thorough analysis of the current condition of Building 18 in particular and Building 22. I can't say with complete certainty that we have built that in, but we think we've unearthed most of the surprises already and that's factored into the budget as presented. Yeah, and David reminded me there is an appropriate contingency built into the project,
right,
even in light of the work that's already been done.
Now we have a quorum, before we take any more questions, I'm going to move House File 228 to be, get my written down here, to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the Capital Investments Division. And members, I'll also move the modified amendment of the A1 amendment of Representative Erdahl, the author's amendment, to put it in the form he wants. So all in favor of the A1 amendment, which for the members that came a little late, that's if you look on page one, line two, get my head together here, instead of inserting $13 million, we're inserting $12 million, and so that's modification that Representative Erdahl made to his amendment. So all in favor of the modified A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The bill's in the condition that the author wants. Is there any further testimony to anybody that wants to speak? Okay. I'll get that next. Anyone else that wants to speak on this bill? Seeing no one coming down, Representative Hertosh, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and really kind of a comment to the committee when we're talking about these types of things. And I don't have an opinion on this particular project, Representative Erdahl or members from the Historical Society, but what I will say in my observation in my time here is I've spent my career and have owned landscape contracting company, a building company, a development company, and what I notice about government is whatever is appropriated, that's what it costs. And, you know, we don't do a very good job of scrutinizing projects. We should be having somebody with some of these large projects reviewing the plans and going over it. It's really crazy the amount of money that it costs government to get something done versus the private sector. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hertosh. Any further questions? Mr. Kelleher. I just demoted you, so then. Mr. Keller.
Then I'd have to run for re-election. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks so much for having us here. I wanted to add two things real quick. You have in your packet a couple of editorials that have appeared in statewide newspapers over the past couple of years, and then a list of organizations that have sent letters of support over the years. So there's wide community support for this project. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that when we're talking about reviews of this project, because this is a National Historic Landmark, this will be receiving extensive historic preservation and archaeology reviews before the National Park Service and the State Historic Preservation Office. I know that there's been some questions and concern that we're not doing that part of the process fully and thoroughly, but I can assure you that we are, and the National Park Service is doing a thorough review. They are consulting with citizens and tribes to make sure that those viewpoints are considered in the consultation process, and it is very, very thorough. So just wanted to add that on the record.
So I'll ask one more time any further questions, and one more time to make sure there's anyone else that wants to speak on this bill. If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 228, as amended, be referred to the Ways and Means Committee with the recommendation that it be re-referred to the Capital Investment Division. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion passed.
Thank you.
Congratulations, and
thank you.
Be on your way. Thank you. And now we'll revert back to our beginning of our agenda that State Auditor Julie Blaha. And also for the members that came in a little late, we're holding the minutes till tomorrow because there's a slight correction that has to be done in them. So,
all right, give it in a moment. Buttons still on, you think they are? Yep. I have to start talking while you fix it. I'll tell you what, I think I can fill some time here. Well, all right. Good morning.
Welcome to the committee, and I see our technical expert is there. He's getting it done. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your presentation.
Good morning. My name is Julie Blaha, and I am your state auditor, and I'm very happy to have gotten here after 2.5 hours. So I'm here to talk about transportation in the northwest suburbs. So, and also, as a former Kelly farmer, I want to say thank God for the for Fort Snelling and being able to move in on that. And I also like to introduce one of our directors, Greg Herlinger, who will also be with us today. I'm sorry, Matt Linneman. Greg Herlinger is one of our deputy, who is over there. Ramona Adviani is also with us today, as well as Donald McFarlane, our communications and legislative outreach person. So we got the whole team here today. Matt will be helping with this presentation. So just to start out, I'd like to start out with our mission. Our mission in the auditor's office is to oversee local government finances for Minnesota taxpayers by helping ensure financial integrity and accountability in local governmental financial activities. Effectively, our work is to oversee over $20 billion in spending every year by local government. We oversee a number of entities. I've listed them out for you. If it's a special district or if it's something special, if it's something local, we are excited about it. Our basic actions are auditing, reviewing, investigating, reporting, and educating. What we do in each one of our divisions is this. We have our office is at 525 Park Street, and this is one of the biggest questions I had as a new auditor was, where is your office? We are just off campus, just kitty corner from the Senate office building. We also have field offices in Duluth, Moorhead, Marshall, Rochester, and Mankato. Right now we have 79 people. People are on staff right now, again including our two deputy director auditors, six directors, and 19 of our staff are in those field offices in greater Minnesota. Now our budget, most of our budget supports staffing. We are people. And the audit division is the largest part of our budget staffing. And here's where I'd like to shift over to Director Linneman to talk about some of the specifics of how we're structured as a budget.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Matthew Linneman with the Office of the State Auditor. So the OSA's budget is dedicated to personnel. 86% of the OSA's budget is spent on personnel, which includes salaries and benefits. The remaining 14% covers other operating costs such as rent, supplies, and equipment. Expenditures by division, as you can see on the chart, 71% of our budget is spent in our audit practice division, with the remaining budget being spread fairly evenly among the other six divisions in the office. Also, if you look at the staffing in our office, the majority of our staff are in our audit practice division, with the remaining divisions, the remaining staff being spread fairly evenly among the remaining six divisions in our office. Expenditures by funding, if you look at our audit practice division, almost all of the costs of our audit practice division are recovered through audit fees. Our TIF division is fully funded by tax enforcement revenue collected from a small percentage of tax increment captured each year at the local government level. Approximately 70% of the pension division's expenditures are an offset or a reduction to state fire aid distributed to local governments each year. Our audit practice division also performs a single audit review as part of the state's subrecipient monitoring, and those expenditures are included in the state's indirect cost plan, which is then submitted to the federal government for reimbursement. So if you look, just approximately a quarter of our budget has a net impact on the general fund.
All right, so getting those basic, that basic structure, let's talk about our divisions.
The audit practice division is, so the Office of State Auditors consists of seven divisions. The largest division is the audit practice division. It primarily performs financial and compliance audits of local governments. Annually, it issues approximately 110 reports and reviews approximately 500 single audits. Division also provides technical assistance and education to local governments' finance staff. Its mission is to serve both the local government client and the public.
And just to note, this is on the extra page that we noticed that we're going to get to a little bit later. In each of these divisions, I want to give you a highlight to give you an example of what we do. In our audit division, we really are the independent specialists in this area. When new standards are implemented, we're able to guide people through that. For instance, we had a major pension fund. When they were dealing with new standards, they looked to us to help us train the people they worked with on these issues. It's kind of like that old line, it's all we do and we do it well. You know, it's our focus. So as a result, we have expertise that you don't see in very many other places. And so next, our tax increment finance division.
The TIF division oversees expenditures of approximately 1,600 tax increment financing districts in Minnesota. It works to educate TIF authorities to understand and comply with TIF laws. It notifies TIF authorities of problems that need to be corrected, and it is funded by a small percentage of tax increment that is captured each year.
So if we take a look, I think one of the things I felt was I think is really impressive about this division is not what, necessarily what you see in the report each year, but what you don't. We have $10.8 million of tax increment that's returned back for whatever reason, you know, voluntarily, required by law. And despite that, few of those have to be formally reported on. That's because education efforts and early communication correct these issues before they become a problem. And as a result, we're all running more efficiently, and we're able to get things back, money back to where it's supposed to be as quickly as possible. All right, so now on to Government Information Division, or GID.
The Government Information Division collects, reviews, and reports on financial information of over 3,300 local governments in Minnesota. GID is the primary source of information for Minnesota state legislators, the U.S. Census Bureau, and other state and local entities, researchers, and the public. It works closely with local governments to help them comply with their legal compliance requirements.
You know, this is one of those places that gets to work very directly with even our smallest units of government, which is terrific. Want to highlight our CTAS system, City and Town Accounting System. Now, as I look around, it's interesting to know who has worked in small local government. You can see their eyes light up a bit. What this is an accounting software package for small cities and towns. It's basically like QuickBooks for Minnesota small cities and towns. In fact, it's so specialized to us, at one point, I believe, Wisconsin asked and see if they could buy it from us. Well, it's a little too specialized, and come on, it's Wisconsin. So we encourage them to try to follow our footsteps. And I also want to give a special shout-out, actually, to Director Lindemann, who was one of the people who designed this system. So not only do we administer it, we actually designed it in-house. There are over 1,400 entities using it right now. That's about 2,800 users. They provide training, and I can attest right now there are over 6,000 annual emails and calls. Believe me, the phone lines are lighting up. I'm getting even questions directed to myself asking about CTAS, and so everything gets to go back to that team as they help people work through basically making sure the money's going where they expect it to go. All right, so now on to our pension division.
The pension division oversees 600 local public pension plans throughout the state. These plans are mostly made up of fire relief associations that support volunteer firefighters. It is a vital source of for trustees of these pension plans. The division responds to thousands of questions each year on a wide range of pension topics.
I'd like to highlight our Volunteer Fire Relief Association Working Group. Now, this is a group that's been around for quite a while. Came in under, I'm not sure if I got this right, it was under Auditor Anderson's tenure, I believe. And I may, you can catch me on that if I have that off. But it convenes a group of firefighters, pension managers, municipal representatives, other stakeholders, and they come together to dig into the nuts and bolts of our local fire relief associations. Now, for many people, for many firefighters, this is a major source of their compensation in firefighting. It's also one of the significant ways we can aid retention and recruitment into the field, particularly in small communities. For instance, this year you'll see a set of recommendations from this working group that They came to unanimously. The way they work is if they don't have unanimity, they don't go forward. So long as I'm here, I'll put a little pitch for any of you that may be on committees that intersect that. It's a wonderful set of helps that are just very specific and very concrete, very helpful. And as a result, they really have helped directly improve our ability to keep our community safe and support some of our hardest working members. All right. So to legal and special investigations.
The Legal / Special Investigations Division provides legal support to all of the OSA. It also investigates allegations of theft and misuse of public funds in local government. When appropriate, it coordinates with local government law enforcement and reports findings to local government prosecutors. The division works proactively to safeguard public dollars by educating the public and local government officials.
All right, I'd love to go through this stuff. This is the stuff that makes you feel, as a young nerd, to make me feel as close to James Bond as you get. And this is some of the things that we've noticed. There are three recent investigations that have come out from Bemidji, Shakopee, and Marshall. They have a lot in common. I'm just going to focus on Shakopee right now. Now, these are situations where our investigators have helped local law enforcement. Whether we found something in these cases, well, law enforcement sought us out. And so let's just kind of focus on Shakopee since that's the most recent one. So in cooperation with the Shakopee Police Department, the OSA was able to help identify over $87,000 of improper transactions. The superintendent has been arrested for swindle and embezzlement, and I believe he has actually pled guilty to a number of those charges. The way we were able to do that was to identify misuse of a purchasing card. And in fact, even in the other two cases, they all involved credit cards and how people are using credit cards, whether they are vendors or if they're dealing with online purchases. So one of the follow-ups to these investigations now is to update a set of best practices for local governments, particularly around online transactions. Things like what constitutes a receipt. If somebody is showing you their credit card transaction record, that's not a receipt. If you have a series of vendors, you might want to call them and make sure they are real. In one case, we were able to find what was called a phantom vendor scheme. This was in Marshall, able to assist in that, where the person was setting up their own vendor basically using their credit card to pay the vendor. Well, that vendor was them, and it would effectively come back to them. Now, sometimes it's elaborate like that. In the case of Shakopee, it was just very directly odd purchases right up on the card, and if you looked at it, you very well know that he probably shouldn't have been making those purchases. But this is the kind of thing where we can see these patterns in our investigations to help prevent them in the future. Okay, I think with the time, we will move to our last set of divisions, constitutional and operations. By the way, that's us right here. That's our divisions.
So the Constitution Division provides the overall leadership of the OSA and fulfills the constitutional duties of the office. The division consists of the State Auditor and her staff. The Operations Division supports the day-to-day operations of the entire office. It provides office management, accounting, technology services necessary to allow other divisions to accomplish their mission.
As you can imagine, the accountant to the state auditors, pretty sharp job. You have some great conversations there. I want to focus on board representation, which is, of course, out of our constitutional division. By the way, the constitutional division is exactly, it's myself and 40% of communications director Donald McFarland. And I have the opportunity to sit on the Board of Investment, Housing Finance Agency, Executive Council, the Land Exchange Board, and the Minnesota Historical Society, which, again, I found out after I was elected and very excited about that, again, as a former employee of the Minnesota Historical Society. My goal here is to provide that financial voice on these boards in particular. In my role, I often have the most time to focus on boards, particularly the Board of Investment and the Housing Finance Agency. And I want to continue the kind of leadership tradition of this office and helping get in the weeds on these boards in particular. Again, it's we are, my also my other part of my job is, of course, our outreach to you. Anything that we do with the legislature, we are moving that through our constitutional division. So supporting the work of the Fire Relief Association, that'll come through us. My opportunities to connect with you, that's coming through the Constitution Division as well. So altogether, what does that do? Together, we ensure local government funds are used for the purpose intended by you all as lawmakers, and that local government can hold themselves to those high standards of accountability. We know everyone in Minnesota is proud of the good government we have. Everyone wants to do right by their constituents. They want to hit these high standards, and we're excited to be able to support that. As we talk about this, I want to highlight how interdependent our office is. When you see it cut into divisions, it's tempting to think it's all in silos, but they regularly work together. For instance, information from our TIF division is used by Government Information Division in their reviews. The policy ideas from pension, like I mentioned before, will go to the Constitution Division for support here. The technology staff from operations help design and maintain the reporting systems our other divisions use. And then legal and special investigations support all of our divisions right now. So we have the chance to work across all through the office. The divisions are probably most stark in a presentation like this. They're far less apparent when you actually come into our office. And I encourage you to do so. On the final page, I have our contact information here. Your direct contact as legislators are myself and Donald McFarland. But you call that main line if you need anything that you're looking for. Our first order of business in this new term is connections. Right now, as many of you know, I either have been in your office or I'm on your schedule to come and meet with you. We also began by meeting with and talking with some of the groups we want to strengthen relationships with. Last Friday, I was on the phone talking to officials from Wright County. We are talking next to Becker County. We are starting to work through and talk to a number of counties up north that are working through re-audits. We are talking with groups that we are, like the Minnesota Society of CPAs, the Association of Counties, Townships, Cities. Our job right now is to reconnect. As I'm sure will come up and has come up, whenever you go through anything difficult, no matter what the outcome is, you strain all those relationships. As a former union negotiator, I know that even if we came to a great resolution on a contract, and everybody came away happy, we had a lot of work to do to rebuild relationships. And so that is the main part right now. So I encourage you all to connect with me, connect with our office, and especially if you know somebody we need to be reaching out to, somebody we need to hear from, whether they're they appreciate our work, whether they have ideas for us to strengthen our work, whether we do their audits directly or we don't, we serve you all and we really want to hear from you. I want to thank you all for inviting us to come before you and have the chance to really describe the great work we're doing. I am so proud to be part of this team and happy to sing their praises any day I get the chance. And with that, I can imagine you may have questions and we're available for those.
Only one or two. Okay. Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Auditor Blaha.
Thank you.
So as you said, audits are all you do and you do it well. And so just wondering if you audit everybody that you can or how what triggers an audit?
You know, we're getting thank you.
Auditor Blaha.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, Representative Akam. I know I get so excited about answering the question that that's my biggest new thing to learn is to wait for you all. That's always an interesting thing looking at what do we have the authority to do and what do we actually do. Now, we have the authority to go in and ask for information and take a look at the finances of virtually any local government entity and entities that are receiving federal funds and local funds. What our job is to figure out the right balance. Just because we can do it doesn't mean we should. Just like one aspirin might cure your headache, eight will not. Our job is to find that balance between ensuring that we have good oversight without overstepping kind of the resources both time, money, and effort that we all have. So a big part of our work is to find that balance right now. And our goal is, again, to use the authority as far as it needs to go, but no further. That is going to be our goal as we go through. So, again, as we have those conversations, I think that's a great place for us to talk about what is the right level of assessment to give us the information we all need to make good decisions. So, yes, that's a great question.
Representative Acom. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. About a year ago, not quite, the auditor mentioned that there were unfilled FTEs and other savings in the department, and they were using that for financing some legal activities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is there still that savings? And then what is the workload of audit requests since the changes?
Auditor Ake. Auditor Blaha.
Auditor is always a fun one to say. Chair Nelson, Representative Quam. That, you know, I think is a great question. The question of workload in our office is a significant one. Auditor Otto was correct in that the way they were able to accommodate the extra costs was by not filling positions as quickly as needed. Now, some of that was just functional, in that those positions are hard to fill, and those gaps were there. So I don't think they forced the gaps or anything. They just, you know, if the gap was there, they let that run out a bit. What I've seen with the staff, which is an amazing staff, and to cover for that, they were picking up extra work, basically. People were all pulling together and doing a lot of extra duty. And it's a group that's been worked real hard. It is not a sustainable way to run the office. So as we have filled those vacancies, the workload has become more manageable. I don't think we could go back to that place, and I think we have to be very sensitive to the stress of that staff, both just to get the work done and for retention on there. But it is true, though. Another point you I think also highlight is if we don't fill positions, or if we don't have the work, we don't fill the positions. In fact, when we do budget requests, you'll see sometimes vacancies that we'll have, knowing that the vacancies are only filled if we have the work. And that might be a little off your topic, but as far as those positions have since been filled, again, we just had someone leave the technology department. We're working to refill that. But it was a model they could do over a very short term. Certainly nothing that is a sustainable way to run that office. This group has been... they're tired. I mean, they work like crazy. They're wonderful. They won't tell you this directly, but this is not going to be a sustainable way to run the office going forward.
Representative Quam.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, the part of the question in regards to the audit workload, my understanding is that once the legislature passed the law, the governor signed it, and options were given to a greater number of counties. Many counties... a large portion didn't, you know, they had the freedom of choosing who audited them before the law, and, you know, more gained that workload probably has diminished. I was trying to find out a little bit idea as to how much that was. It'd also be nice to understand how the targeting is for counties for reviewing outside audits, and then thanks for the clarification that the testimony given by the previous auditor last year was not forthright on the savings that were utilized for the legal expenses.
I'm not sure I heard a question there, but
Mr. Chair, the question was the second part of the original discussion was the audit load and the personnel, which is sort of tied into the unfilled spots.
Okay.
And then the additional part that was added this time was the understanding of how counties are targeted for verification of external audits.
I see the auditor shaking her head, and Auditor Blaha.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Representative Quam, let me see if I can explain it a little more clearly. And again, feel free to hop in, Director Lindemann. You know, the I believe Auditor Otto was accurate in what she said. So if I'm saying anything that was in conflict, I want to make sure I'm not making an error on here. I think that what gets a little tricky is which division things are coming out of, and maybe that's the issue, is some of the vacancies were not necessarily out of the audit division. The way the audit division is staffed is, since we have to set our pricing based on the hours that we work, as the audit dropped, those positions were not refilled. So right now we have, what, about 20 vacancies, I think, right now or so? 15 vacancies in our audit division that are unfilled. And so so as the audits did drop, so did the audit staff. In fact, the staffing, I think, over time, I think at its highest point in our office, under Auditor Dutcher, I think there were approximately 145 staff. We are currently down to 79. So over time, we have seen a drop in overall staffing and staffing specific to the audit division as well, if that helps clarify a bit. If not, I could also, I know we also get a chance to meet next week, I believe, and let me see if I can also give you more specific answers to those questions. We can hash those out a little bit more, if that's helpful. And then, how are counties chosen? You know, one of the things that I encourage you to read on our website is our audit guide. I can also give you a copy. Most people see I'm carrying it around with me. I think it's amazing. Some people find it less scintillating reading than I do. But it does have a section there on how we choose who we check for. I think what you're thinking of is the work paper reviews, correct? And we have a set of criteria for that. It might be one we want to sample from each of the firms that are out there that we can. If there's a place we haven't gone to in a while, we want to ensure that if we have seen a group in their desk review had a significant number of problems, we're going to go in there. We have, a set of six criteria that we are using to do that. And another goal we have is to share that criteria so that people this is a predictable thing. The people have an understanding of why they're chosen, that it doesn't seem random. It doesn't seem it is based on good practice and the best attempt to get good information about their work. But I'll also bring that at our next meeting, too, to give you the specific criteria that we're using.
Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Auditor, thanks for being here this morning. Thanks for stopping by the office. I also want to thank you for your willingness to engage in some frank conversation about how do you best move forward from some of the stuff that we've seen in the last number of years. As somebody who's sat on this committee now for my third term, I was pleased with the frankness and the honesty of the discussion that we had, and I just wanted to say that I appreciate that. There is a great deal of, I would say, relationship mending, as you've referenced, that needs to be done with the counties and with many members of the legislature. So I just wanted to say thanks for being willing to be frank and honest. That was, as I said, refreshing. You know, as we move forward, I think it's good to have that blunt conversation. Rumor has it I might be a little bit blunt. I see Representative Olson giggling over there. That's okay, and that's the best part, I think, of serving in this body and working with members of the executive branch and constitutional officers, to have the conversation about what's best for Minnesota. And I want to make sure that you know that I'm willing to work with you on things. We probably won't agree on everything or some things, every now and then one or two things, but I appreciate the frankness and the openness. So thanks very much, Mr. Chair.
No question there. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Madam Auditor, this question is for you. You mentioned a few things during your presentation that I would just like to ask some clarification. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the fact that the work is interconnected, but my question to you is then when you're developing your budgets, how distinct are the divisions and their budgets? That's the first question. And then if you'll permit me to go ahead and ask the second question, and then you can answer them at the same time. And then you also mentioned that a quarter of your budget has a direct impact on the general fund. Mm-hmm. So my question is, do audit fees reimburse the general fund for all divisions?
Auditor Blaha.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Nelson, Representative Claymore. This is a, yeah, that's a great question. Also coming as my most recent role was as a treasurer of an organization. And I think that looking at, while we have all these fees coming in, where we have fees coming in, those are really directly tied. For instance, when money comes in for TIF, that's going to go to TIF. When money comes in from audit fees, that's going to audit. In fact, our fees are based on covering all our costs very directly. So that's really tied tight. The single audit fees go to the single audit. The pension fees will go to the pension, I mean, because it's offset by those. So when it gets down to then budgeting the balance of it, the net, what we have from the general fund really covers a lot of things that are really interconnected. So I know looking at this as a treasurer was a challenge. For instance, I'll use Director McFarland as an example. Here is the communications director. If you have to have really tight lines on here, where do I allocate him? I want to make sure that, you know, when he is helping the TIF division make sure their presentations are clear with really complicated information. Okay, so we put 10% over there. And so when we have a sharply delineated budget, it gets really difficult to take interconnected people and spread them out effectively. So we're trying to be as absolutely as accurate as possible when we budget, partly because that's something we're all proud of just as financial people. But flexibility is needed, especially if we realize a savings, for instance. If we were to realize a savings in the Constitution Division, it might make most sense for that savings to actually be applied to the Pension Division, where they're developing something we were lobbying on, working on. So I think wherever we can have flexibility, it's a lot more helpful. Knowing that, though, if anything is coming in that is from a particular source, that's directly tied, and we do not move that around. So the only flexibility we usually ask for is in the places that don't have direct funding sources, if I've gotten that right. Thank you for the question.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you.
Representative Carlson, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Auditor Blaha, again, thank you for taking the time to come meet with me. Being new to this committee, I appreciate you stopping by and kind of giving a sense of this before mm-hmm. today's presentation. Back to the staffing issue, within the Constitutional Division, what positions are funded within that division?
Auditor Blaha.
Chair Nelson, Representative Carlson. It's always a fun one to talk about when I talk to legislators. As far as the Constitutional Division, it's me and a little bit of Donald. I don't have an executive assistant. We don't have a chief of staff. We don't have a specific legislative outreach person. I have less direct administrative support than legislators do. Which is something we'll talk to you about in a couple of weeks, I am pretty sure. One of the things is this office has, to accommodate budget issues, really thinned down, probably to the point that we are now having some troubles getting things done. For instance, our special investigations legal division also does not have administrative support. Because of the way our budget is set up, one of the things I came in thinking, well, maybe I can get... I'm not a 12-year auditor. I need a little more support, possibly, and seeing if I can move it across. But we do have restrictions in our budget. We are not able to move money from division to division, so I'm not able to use any savings to get myself an executive assistant at this point. I have to come to you for a change item on there. So I think that's something where, with a goal of outreach, we need to have the kind of support so we can be out there and directly connecting to the people we serve. So I think that's something that's different in our office than any other constitutional office, and I think even any legislator at this point. It's just me and a small part of the communications director. Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Auditor, I recall that from our conversation and look forward to your budget presentation.
Yes.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Madam Auditor. I reflect Representative Nash's comments on being able to, you came by my office, and I appreciated having that conversation. I was curious on the pie chart on the expenditures. You know, last year I believe the Enterprise Fund was repealed, and now it goes through the general fund, probably then has to be an appropriation. And how, if that reflects that or if that will be changing relative to what the new legislation is, since it's not really an enterprise fund anymore, as I understand it.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Lindemann.
Mr. Representative, the pie chart here represents the Audit Practice Division being part of the general fund, so that is showing the current situation. So for the current biennium that we're in right now, we're part of the general fund, and this represents our base budget for the next biennium, which is based off of this biennium.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you. Also, Representative Quam had referred to that time back when we were maybe a little short-staffed, and there was a problem with I remember being on the Pension Commission, the Austin Relief Association, and not being caught for a few years, and therefore led to some legislation as well as some financial difficulties for the city. I'm wondering, first of all, if that, and it's hard for me to remember everything that went into that bill, if that's been completely taken care of, and secondly, if you've looked within the department to make sure that things, that you have the proper staffing so things like that don't happen again.
Auditor.
Chair Nelson, Representative, I don't want to speak into too much detail on that. Being a little new, I know something about that. I know we did not actually do that original audit. We didn't do that audit. And I think more conversation would be, if we want to catch something like that, when a private firm is doing those audits, we could talk about how we can help with that oversight. The way that pension division has been funded is with, again, money from the pension fund. So am I right about that?
It's a general fund appropriation, just part of those.
Making sure that we cover, I'm going to have, why don't you explain that? Because I don't want to explain offsets wrong here.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative, the pension division is funded as a part of our general fund appropriation. It's just that 70% of the expenditures are a reduction in expenditures as part of the state fire aid that's distributed by the state. So it's a reduction in expenditure somewhere else when we spend it. So it's not really revenue coming into us.
But I think also...
Auditor.
Thank you. I think to your question, I'd have to dig into that a bit more. I believe if we were going to prevent problems like we think we saw in Austin, if I'm understanding it right, we would need to take over more of those kind of audits. And so I think we'd have to have a longer discussion about staffing and expanding some of our work in that area. Definitely be open to having that longer conversation about that. One of the things right now, we're actually not necessarily, again, since it's going out privately, we're not necessarily going to see that without doing the audit ourselves, or more looks into the work papers, and that may be something that we may want to talk about, and whether that's a reasonable function for the office.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, well, my understanding is that the auditor's office is reviewing the audits that are done, and that's where the oversight wasn't properly done in the auditor's office, was my understanding, and therefore this thing occurred for like 2 or 3 years going forward. And the real question was, my concern is the staffing there. Mm-hmm. That if the auditor's office is indeed responsible for oversight of those audits, that it's going to be done and that you're going to have the staff proper. I'm not suggesting, I would advocate that the relief associations to still have their flexibility to do the audit the best they feel they can. But what you are is the check and the balance over that, and therefore the question is, are we properly staffed there now? Because I wasn't sure whether it was taken care of, whether it is or isn't. We still need to go forward and make sure that the function is able to be done properly.
Auditor.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Representative, I think we should probably have a more direct, maybe an offline conversation on that too, because as we get into the weeds of that issue about this was, when you talk about legal compliance, you're going to catch that with a desk audit, which is the desk reviews that we do. Or do we have to go in deeper for a deeper look to be able to catch that kind of thing that normally wouldn't be caught on that? This is something I believe your general counsel can assist with, but I think the idea of a desk review might not catch the problem that we saw, and if we're concerned that problem is going forward, we may have to talk about what level of look are we going to have to take to do that? To do a deeper look, might not actually come out of the pension division. That might come out of the audit division. And a look like that generally also uses fees. So as far as staffing, there may be a mechanism that we can do that with our structure now. But I believe that might be bringing in the audit division to that. Might be the way we handle it without having to staff up additionally in pensions. But again, that's a fun, weedy discussion that we should have going forward, and I definitely will dig into that some more and have a deeper conversation about are we able to find those kind of things.
And Representative Kwong. Representative Volga had one more question.
I'm sorry. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more question, because I know that there's been a task group meeting on the Volunteer Firefighters Relief Associations, and I'm curious how the auditor's office looks at this, and the reason I'm asking that is one of the discussions that was happening was there was a few volunteer departments that were being converted to full-time paid departments, and there's a lot of question then, was the relief money that came into those volunteer departments really set aside for those volunteers, or was that benefit artificially maybe set a little lower by the city council, therefore there's a little more of a fund sitting there at the city that could subsidize the paid after they're there. So trying to paraphrase that, my question is, as the state auditor's office, do you look at yourself as kind of a representative, supportive party for those volunteer fire departments as they get into this discussion, or are you just an arbiter looking at it and saying, look, we'll put together the work group, but we're not there necessarily to defend the 2% tax that went into the relief associations versus the cities maybe wanting to move it a little over toward their pension obligation?
Madam Auditor.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Representative, this is, if we're just having that conversation as we talk about how do we decide, particularly as a constitutional division, how do we decide when we take a position and when we don't? And our work, when we're working on those boards, traditionally it has been that we support the things that the boards are coming to unanimously. And our job is to support their will, the will of the groups that come together and come to agreement. So our job is to get you the cleanest information we can so that you all can make the decision. And so our job is not to put our thumb on the scale and push policy one direction or another in that, particularly in that case. And it's also the idea that we do believe that the best ideas will come from those people closest to the issue, and that those are our firefighters, those are the people running those relief associations, and we want those decisions to come from them. So our work is to give the cleanest, most complete information we can, but our work is not to decide between the policies. So we don't want to step into your world on that. And again, our job is to kind of help get out the will of the body that we're convening without pushing it in one direction or another. And this is also why we have a standard of unanimity in those committees before we bring things forward. If it's not unanimous, then people go off and present it in their own ways. But when it's unanimous, that's who we're coming together with.
Thank you. Representative Kwong, and we move forward, we'll get going. We have one more person that wants to testify on the.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since the point of desk audit, desk review came up, I was hoping to get some reassurances that instead of past practices, which were well documented, to not be following your own or the auditor's own checklists and procedures, will the auditor's office going forward, when they target a county or a local entity for review of an external audit, actually follow the same checklist and desk procedures as our internal?
Madam Auditor.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, Representative Kwong. I would suggest that we have even better standards than I've and it's because we are working more closely right now with the Minnesota Society of CPAs in particular. In fact, we met with them recently, and they suggested we meet regularly with the private firms that we review, and we thought that was a terrific idea. And so we are setting up a structure where we can regularly be meeting with those private firms, so they know our expectations. We're getting their feedback. We know what they need from us, what we need from them. And then also sharing any new changes that we see. Again, if you look at our audit guide, the new section that was added and updated in November, this section includes the work the work paper review section, and that goes through the exact timelines. We're very clear about it, and it's a way where we've come a long way. We took input, in fact, from the Minnesota Society of CPAs to update our policies so that we both balance the need for the time for them to be able to get a fair and honest review, and the time needs of our counties to get good information about their firms. So we think we've come to a great place, a great balance, so we're continuing to talk about that. One new thing you'll see is that we may be one of the only places in the country that will be allowing our on a work paper review the firm to actually put in writing a response that we will also put up on our website if we do publish a report on those things. So I think we've made some great progress on that, and our job is to prove that to you with this round of work paper reviews. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Madam Auditor, and hopefully we'll continue to have the good working relationship.
Again, I want to thank you all for being so welcoming to me, and I can't wait for what we'll do next. Thank you.
And members of as they're moving on here, we have a Stephanie Chapel who wanted to speak on the Fort Snelling bill, and I'm going to invite her down here now to speak. Is she in the audience? Okay. I apologize that we took that bill first and not the way on the order of the agenda, but the auditor had trouble getting here because of traffic, so we juggle, and sometimes we do that in committees all the time. So please introduce yourself for the tape and then proceed with your testimony, and we do have your handout been passed out to all the members.
Well, thank you. My name is Stephanie Chapel of Glencoe, Minnesota, and I emailed all a copy of some research that I did, and I just wanted to voice my opinion that I believe that the graves that are there deserve our respect. I just noticed while viewing the articles in your handout that Governor Al Quie mentioned it too, that we ought to respect our ancestors, respect those who came before us, and that's what needs to be done. It was an oversight, overlook, something that just didn't get noticed, perhaps in 1980. But it happens. It was claimed to have been cleared up in 1905. It wasn't. In 1911, there were more bodies found that had to be disinterred and reinterred. So I ask you on behalf of those who are there, a couple of stories are in the brochure for you, to please consider that hallowed ground. I thank you for your time, and please do not let this continue. At least not now. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for being here, and hope you have a good drive home. I understand you have a short drive.
No, not really.
No.
May I ask if you allowed it to go through?
It did pass to go through to the next committee, yes. It's going to be, it'll be re-referred. It was referred to Ways and Means Committee, and then it'll be sent to from there to the Capital Investment Division. So
yeah, it's headed for Capital Investment tomorrow.
So hopefully you can make it in and testify there, and I wish you a good day.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. Please contact me if you have questions.
I was going to say, are there any questions of the testifier? Ms. Claiborne, Representative Claiborne.
Mr. Chair, just as a As a new member of the committee, I just will ask the information. This is an informational question for you as chair. When someone comes to testify, such as this testifier, after an action has been taken by our committee, is it possible for us to share this memo with the next committee, or is it incumbent on the testifier to bring the information forward? It's just a procedural question that I'm asking.
We can forward it on to the next committee, the information. She sent an email that I believe the email has all this that she sent with the information to all of us. I saw it this morning when I came in,
okay.
And I did inform Representative Erdahl. I'm not sure if she sent it to Representative Erdahl also, but I did forward the email to Representative Erdahl, and we can forward it to the next to the Capital Investments Committee so that they have the information and going forward from there. So we can do that. And typically when, you know, like I said, sometimes our agendas get jumbled because of weather, because of other issues, people not here on time, people having bills in other committees. And we try and make efficient use of the time so we can get through our hour and a half that we have in the mornings so we can get out of here so the next committee can get in. And when a person like Ms. Chappell shows up that wanted to testify in it, I try and make an effort to let them testify. Likewise, if we have a committee and then we have to go later in the evening to finish the work of the committee, people that come from out of town, it may not be a bill that's up in front of us, that we will let them testify ahead of taking that bill up because they made the effort to get here in the morning. And if we're coming back at 6, they may not be able to be back here at 6. So we let them get their testimony out of the way so that the general public can have their input on these things. And these meetings are recorded, so your testimony is recorded. And like I said, we will forward your information on to the next committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other further questions from members? If not, thank you for your testimony and thank you for coming here today.
And I thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all.
And with that, members, no further business being before us, this meeting is adjourned.